Welcome to Radio Naturopath, the call and talk show about health and natural medicine. It's January 15, 2020. I am France Dortendi, naturopathic physician with my co-host Ron Menizza. If you'd like to participate in the conversation about natural medicine, you can call us at 860-486-9487. That's 860-486-9487. You can also email me at radionaturopath@gmail.com. You can also check out my Facebook page, Twitter, and Instagram at FranStorchND. If you'd like to listen to the show at another time, you can check out our podcast at whus.org. The views expressed on this program do not reflect the views of the staff, management, or licensee of this station. All right. So it's a great day today. It's going to be nice out, a little bit nice out. The sun is out. One interesting thing is, if you wanted to sign up for Access Health CT, if you need to sign up for the exchange for insurance, just to let you know that today is the last day of the open enrollment period. So if you need to sign up today, you have to do it today. And you can do that at Access Health CT. I believe that it's either .com or .org, but you can do it online. You can call them, and you can also, there are fairs. If you go to the Access Health CT website, you can go live and sign up that way. But today is the last day for open enrollment. So that's kind of interesting. Just a tip if that's something you're needing to do. All right. So my first topic for today is about the herb neem. It has a cute name. It's an Ayurvedic herb. It's an herb that's used largely in India. I'm very happy with it because I admit that I have some fungus on my feet. And foot fungus is a thing I deal with. And thank you, Daddy, because I inherited my my dad's penchant for acquiring this. And I spend time in gyms and I get pedicures, and so I'm prone to it because not everybody gets athlete's foot, and not everybody gets athlete's foot as bad as everybody else. And so I put over-the-counter tolnaphdate and terbinafine, which are pharmaceuticals that you can get over-the-counter at drugstores, and you know they have brand names. And I tried those, and they weren't working. I put straight tea tree oil on my feet, and you know, you shouldn't necessarily do that. Shouldn't put straight tea tree oil on your feet unless you know for sure. That you should do a patch test first and see if you have a reaction to it. And then if you don't, then you can use straight tea tree oil. But it's usually a good idea to use tea tree oil in a carrier oil or in a lotion or an ointment or cream. And you can mix that up yourself or you can get them prepared. I just got myself a nice tea tree oil ointment, but it wasn't working. And I had a lovely lotion that had a lot of herbs in it, that had coconut oil and tea tree oil and lavender and a bunch of other things in it. And that wasn't doing it either. So I just didn't know what to do. So finally I decided, hey, what if I tried neem? And because I know neem is a nice antifungal, and I was going to go to my distributor and get some neem oil. Now, when you order neem oil, the interesting thing is you can either get straight up neem essential oil, which they do recommend. You know, if you're going to use it straight, you want to use a tiny amount and you want to do a patch test first. But generally what people do is they use neem in a carrier oil. So when you order neem oil, you're either going to get straight neem essential oil or you're going to get neem usually blended into sesame oil, and sesame oil is a big deal in Ayurvedic medicine, in Indian medicine. So we're talking Indian from India, that's either of the ways you would get it. So I was going to order that, and then I looked to my shelf and I saw that we had at the office we had neem tincture because somebody was using it. So I grabbed a bottle of the neem tincture. Because I started putting it on thinking it was neem oil, and it wasn't. It was in alcohol. It was a neem tincture. So I put it on my feet. Within a few minutes, the itching was a lot better. And then I continued to apply it over the next days, and the athlete's foot magically got so much better. And this was with neem tincture. What I probably will do is get neem, straight up neem oil and neem in sesame oil and use those as well and see how well they work. But the tincture works really well. It was incredible. My concern is putting alcohol directly on my feet regularly. I don't know if that's going to be a problem, but it's amazing that it worked like a charm. It's just incredible. So I've been continuing to apply it, and the lesions are they're not red anymore. They're healing. It's just amazing. Yeah. So
it's crazy. That works good. Yes. And it's Neem, NEEM.
That's right.
Right?
Yes. Okay. Yes. So neem is this neat thing, and here's some information about the plant. So it's heavily used in India. The Latin name is, Aziraghta indica, and it's native to India. And in Sanskrit, they call it Arista, which means something that's perfect, imperishable, and complete. So remember the record label Arista from, I don't know if that still exists, but that's a Sanskrit word, which means something perfect, imperishable, and complete. So if that's how you feel about your music, that's a good name for a record label.
I see.
Yeah. It's considered to have anti-aging properties. It's a great antioxidant. It protects the skin from UV rays. So neem is something that can go it's a nice ingredient to have in a sunscreen. I didn't realize that. There are vitamins and fatty acids in neem, and it improves and maintains the elasticity of the skin, reduces wrinkles and fine lines. So that would be a reason to get the neem in a carrier oil, to get the neem in sesame oil, and you can apply it. It smells very earthy. Not everybody would like the smell. I don't mind it, but it does have kind of an earthy smell.
What do you mean? Like dirt earthy?
Yeah, kind of like that. Oh. You know, kind of. It's not sweet and flowery. It's not like lavender. It's not minty. It's definitely earthy. I would compare it a bit to patchouli, but patchouli has a very distinctive odor, but it doesn't smell like that. It smells earthy. I don't know how to describe it. It's like, you know, kind of like, you're right. It's kind of like good dirt. I'll let you smell the tincture. You can describe how it smells.
Yeah, now you got my interest.
Yeah, it's got, if you were talking in fragrance terms, you might say it has mossy notes. Mossy, like oak, moss, that kind of thing. Yeah, that's how it smells. It smells,
okay.
Smells earthy. Right. So it's a wonderful antifungal, as we discovered, and it's also antibacterial. So it's something you can take for infections, and people do use it as one of the herbs that they use for Lyme disease. Ayurvedic medicine is Indian medicine, and it's been used as a key ingredient. Most Ayurvedic doctors will have it in certain preparations. And it's part of many home remedies. As we said, it's also an insecticide. And in India, people will keep neem-soaked cotton near the windows or burn neem leaves to ward off insects. You could probably put it out. I don't know. I wonder how it would. Well, it works for mosquitoes. They're saying it works for mosquitoes. I wonder if it would work for ants, you know, because we always get ants in the spring.
Hmm.
Yeah, that you just, you know, soak some cotton balls in neem oil and put them out and see what happens. I wonder how mice would feel about it, because we're having mouse issues.
Yeah, well, we have one less mouse issue.
I see.
Yeah, I extracted a visitor this morning.
Well, I must be a mouse, because I was getting something from the cabinet in the foyer, and I got snapped.
Oh, yeah, watch out. There's traps out there.
Fortunately, I got snapped on my boot, so it didn't hurt me, but I did snap the trap. I felt bad. I'm like, oh, I snapped the trap. I don't know what to do about it. Did you fix that trap?
No, now that I know, I will fix that
trap. It's the trap in front of the... You put a trap in front of the cabinet in the foyer. It's not a good place for it.
I put it over by the recycle bin.
Yeah, not a good place for it, because I stepped on it. It was right where I stepped, so...
Okay.
Because I snapped it. Neem, good for your teeth. I have a nice herbal mouthwash that I use, and it is an American herbal mouthwash, but it's, you know, it's an herbal that's sort of a health food store brand, and neem is one of the ingredients in it. They call it nature's toothbrush, and if you go to the health food store, you will find that there are many neem toothpastes, and in India, they chew on the twigs for dental hygiene, and that's one way to do it. So if you can get neem twigs, you could chew on them. But you can just buy neem toothpaste and neem and toothpaste that have neem as part of its makeup. And so it is antibacterial, so it's going to help with plaque, and it is anti-inflammatory. So if you have thrush, it would be another good thing to use. Neem is supposed to help your hair. It helps hair growth, and they use it topically. Again, it's antibacterial, antifungal, and anti-inflammatory, so it's good for your scalp. So you can get shampoo with neem in it, and it strengthens the hair follicles. So that's kind of a nice thing. And it has they put it on they use it for eczema too. So that's kind of an interesting thing. So it's anti-inflammatory and antimicrobial. So you could put it on any rash, and it might be helpful. And that's where I would probably get the neem in sesame oil. And you can also use it if you have an open wound. It can be one of the ingredients in your healing cream. If you are, you know, like we usually use calendula cream, there can be neem in there. You know, you can put it on wounds and scars, and it's antimicrobial, so it'll speed healing. The other thing is I have a pimple on my face, and I don't get a lot of pimples, but I happen to have one. And I'm excited about it, which sounds really silly, because I'm you know, if you struggle with acne, I'm sorry. I mean, that's a really hard thing, and there's a lot of things that you can try to do for it. But guess what? One of the things you can do is apply neem to your pimples. So I forgot, because I just have the one, and I forget about it. And, you know, I'm not, you know, in high school, so nobody's looking at me. Or maybe they are, and if they are, I don't care. Can you see my pimple?
No.
Okay, it's right here.
Okay.
Right under my nose. So I see the pimple as an opportunity, which I often do with health conditions. And oh, good, I got a thing. How am I going to treat it? So I forgot to put the neem tincture on the pimple, and I should do that to see what happens. So that would be a neat thing to do.
Keep it away from children, by the way, small children.
Oh.
There's a warning about it. It says that insufficient research has been done to assess the purported benefits of neem. However, you know that it works. In adults, short-term uses of neem is safe, while long-term use may harm the kidneys or liver in small children.
Okay.
Neem oil is toxic and lead to death.
All right.
It may also cause miscarriages, infertility, and low blood sugar.
So who's saying this?
Oh, it's on a Wikipedia page.
Right. So that's right. Wikipedia. So who, and so, again, that's a Wikipedia page, and who's saying it in the Wikipedia page?
It is right. In reference to number 17. Oh, my God. Bunches of people listed here for further reading and external links.
So there's some cautions to it.
You probably, some cautions, but
probably don't want to use it long term, and you may want to, consider what other things for kids.
Right.
And so neem is, there is a neem seed cake, which is a neem seed residue.
Just saw that.
That you can use. And, you know, people use it topically. They use it as a moisturizer. And again, you're going to find it in all kinds of health and beauty, health and beauty stuff. It is also, because it's an insect repellent, you can also take it internally. It is often an ingredient when people are fighting internal candida, and they are used, and it is used to help to fight Lyme disease. It's one of the things that tends to be used. So neem, I'm excited because I had a really nice experience treating my athlete's foot. I also tend to get the toenail fungus, and I'm going to put the neem underneath my toenails and see if it helps me that way too. So I'll report back. I'll let you know. So neem, your friend in antimicrobial and healthcare and skincare and stuff. All right. So the next thing is kind of a fun topic, and why should you use body lotion? Maybe you should use some body lotion with neem in it. Find some lotion because it is good for your skin. And body lotion is nice. It can impart nutrition directly to your skin. That's one of the things I like about it. Now, your skin can get dry in the winter, of course. And in the wintertime, one of the ways you can help with that is to put stuff on your skin as a barrier and as something that can help with healing. If you get those little tiny cracks in your fingers because you work outside, one of the things that happens is both dehydration, and because your hands get cold, you can get cracks in your skin. So there are salves that you can use, and probably one with neem would be helpful. But I like to use heavy calendula salves, things with cocoa butter, olive oil, jojoba oil, shea butter. Heavier fats like that can be really nice for your skin. And things like coconut oil is antimicrobial. It definitely can help to fight fungus and bacteria. And one of the reasons that you'll get those cracks and they won't heal so fast is because there's bacteria that live on your skin and kind of keep them going. So if you can disinfect them, you'll tend to heal faster. What's up?
We had a caller.
Okay.
And the caller is listening and is very interested. And she is an avid fitness instructor and local person. And she said her athlete's foot solution for many, many years has been Vicks VapoRub on the bottom of her
right.
feet with Crocs on.
That's great. And I tried that. And
you
it
tried
didn't
that.
Work. Yeah. Which is great.
So we really appreciate the call. But Fran has industrial strength athlete's foot.
I guess. Well, here's the thing. That my concern with Vicks VapoRub is its base is petroleum jelly. And so I'm not crazy about it.
You're not crazy about that. Yeah, I
right.
know. We've talked about that. Yep.
Yes. And so Vicks, but the reason it does work is because there are essential oils in it. There's
right.
So you know. So
yeah.
There's essential oils.
Try to find out what the base is on that.
Yeah, it's. So yeah, what you want to know is Vicks VapoRub ingredients, and the ingredients that unfortunately its base is in it's got camphor in it. It's got eucalyptus oil. It's really got some great essential oils in it. That's why it works, because it has camphor and eucalyptus oil and menthol, and it has cedar leaf oil, nutmeg oil, thyme oil, and turpentine oil, all things which are going to, they're antifungal, but it's in a base of petrolatum, which is why I'm not crazy about it.
Turpentine oil.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
It's gonna kill anything.
Yeah.
It's just that it's in petroleum, and I'm not crazy about putting petroleum jelly on. You can get health food store brands, and also you can get them at the drugstore. There are chest rubs that don't have those that aren't in a petroleum base. So there's one. I saw one at the drugstore, and there's a few brands that you can get, and that you can actually buy. And you know, they'll have similar ingredients, but they'll be in a base that's usually beeswax and beeswax and olive oil, and then you can put those on, and those oils are actually good for your skin. But they'll have some similar herbs in it, and so I have one of those, and I put it on, and it didn't do anything. But if that works for you, that's great.
Yeah,
it's really good.
Yep.
I mean, those other things
should
have worked.
She's been using it for years, and it seems to be effective. So
the tea tree oil is, tea tree oil is great, and all those herbs, the cedar leaf oil, and all those other things, they're really great. It just, I was having a, I had Martian. I had Martian fungus, I guess. I don't know. The other thing that works is not wearing shoes. That one of the reasons that you get fungus and that the fungus sticks around is because we wear shoes. And we sweat inside our shoes.
And,
we wear shoes and socks. And so you're if you're in a warm, moist environment, it's a great environment for a fungus to thrive. And so... so you have to, and that's why you get stuck with these fungi. So if you can be barefoot around your house, the only issue with that is if you're barefoot, then you can track the dermatophytes, the fungus around your house, which is why when you're in the house, you take your socks off and you can wear Crocs, for example, or you can wear flip-flops.
Right.
And I find, though, when I put lotion-y things on my feet and I'm wearing flip-flops or Crocs, then I slide around in them. I also discovered, don't put lotion on your feet before you go to yoga class, because you won't be able to stick to your mat.
You're going to be slipping.
Yes.
Yeah.
You'll be slipping on your mat, so you kind of can't do that. So using the neem tincture was a real boon, because it's in alcohol and it evaporates. And so that so I could put that on before I went to yoga. I could put that on any time. It's really great. The other thing that works is if you can do it, you go to the beach and you walk on the beach barefoot.
Yay. We did that.
We did that. And you walk, and especially if you walk at the water's edge, you'll get exfoliation. Your feet will get, as the tide comes in, you'll get a treatment of sea salt. And one thing I didn't do this trip, but I did last trip, is I sat by the waterside and I gave myself a sand scrub. So I just scrubbed my feet with sand. And that was a great exfoliant treatment. So walking at the beach is really great. And then being in the sun, letting your feet kind of bake in the sun, that's another great thing that you can do. And if you put neem on, it helps protect against UV rays. So you can put neem on and then sit in the sun, and then you get some UV, but you'll get some protection of it, and you'll get antifungal. But the sunlight is antifungal and antimicrobial. It does kill microorganisms. That's why it's a good idea, if you can do it, if you can manage it, to hang your laundry outside. When you hang your laundry outside, you get sunlight on it, and it'll kill microorganisms. And, running it in the dryer does too, but sometimes you don't want to throw things in the dryer because the high heat in the dryer will destroy your clothes. And the other thing about putting your clothes in sunlight is it will bleach out the colors in your clothes, unfortunately.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so. Anyway, so that was kind of interesting, but people definitely use Vicks VapoRub, but if you want to go that route, my recommendation would be to use a natural brand, one that you get at the health food store. And like I said, you can find natural brands at the drugstore. If you are traveling somewhere or you're not able to find your favorite health food store, but you can find, a chain drugstore. Drugstores definitely have there are brands they have of natural products that you can grab when you're traveling, even if it's not, the products you're used to using. So, and they definitely have herbal chest rubs that are not, petroleum-based. All right. So here's another thing. I'm grateful to a patient for bringing this to my attention. There is a new test called Viome. So I'm not directly recommending this, but I found it interesting. This test, with this test, you send a stool sample and it tells you various foods to eat or avoid based on your microbiome. How interesting is that? So you send a stool sample and based on what's growing in your stool, it gives you information about what might be good for you to eat or not. And one of the things that it tests, it's called Viome. Viome is taken from biome, the microbiome. Biome is the microorganisms that live inside in your body. So your microbiome is the microorganisms that live all over your body. And your microbiome is on your skin. Any place on your body that communicates with the outside world has a microbiome. So your entire skin, that's why, when you get the cuts, like I said, the bacteria, unfortunately, will keep inflammation and keep the cuts going. And so that's part of the microbiome. And, you have Staph aureus that just hangs out on your skin. And if it gets an opportunity, it'll flourish. And then it can give you things like, it can do something as simple as make your little cut a little bit redder for a while. And something as serious as give you impetigo, which is a bad infection it's a bad skin infection from Staph aureus. So Viome is called Viome because it tests for viruses. So if there's certain viruses that live on foods and they find them in your stool, they'll recommend that you avoid them and you might feel better. So that's interesting. What I haven't looked into is how does this really bear out? Just because you have a virus that lives on that tends to live on a food, should you then avoid the food? Is that virus actually doing something bad to you? That's a really good question. But in this sample does recommend that you avoid those foods. And so I had a patient do this. Well, she actually did it on her own. She found it and she did it on her own. It's not terribly expensive. If you try it, she tried it and it was helpful for her. She had some digestive upset and her digestive upset improved when she followed the recommendations. There were a couple things for some reason by the what they found in her stool, they found certain viruses and they told her to avoid these certain foods. And they also found certain microbiota that indicated that she might have blood sugar issues. So there were certain foods that she should probably stay away from to help to regularize her blood sugar. And that was interesting. This is different than it's a kind of food intolerance test. It is a food intolerance test, but it's not the same as an IgG food. It's not an antibody test. It's a test basically that looks at your microbiome and sees what's growing in there and sees what could be causing irritation, inflammation based on the presence of viruses and the presence of microflora that may indicate blood sugar regulation issues. That company also happens to offer an IgG food allergy test. So that's interesting too. So an IgG food allergy test is a test where you're looking at long-acting antibodies, where your body encodes proteins in your blood. It encodes B lymphocytes to fight against proteins that are in foods. And there's some controversy about whether how effective this is. However, there are studies that do show that if you do an IgG food allergy test, it was studied on irritable bowel syndrome. People who do an IgG food allergy test and then follow the recommendations do have a relief in symptoms. And we tossed around a statistic when I was in school that food allergy tests are about 70% accurate. So some of the things are going to be. So, you know, when it says that there like a random vegetable that you have a problem with, so you have an IgG allergy to broccoli, you might want to take that with a grain of salt. But if you have, if you see a trend, like you have raised antibodies to yogurt, cheese, cow's milk, whey, casein, you might want to stay away from dairy. And if you see like not a lot's coming up in terms of the fruits and vegetables, but 5 grains come up, you might want to consider, do you want to back off on grains or do you want to back off on the specific grains? If any nuts come up, it's probably nuts and seeds come up. Nuts and seeds can tend to be antigenic. So it's probably a good idea to try avoiding those. And you can do elimination and challenge with these diets. And what's interesting is these tests, these IgG food allergy tests, are becoming more available to the public and available to be accessed without a doctor, which is kind of interesting. It's probably a good idea if you're going to do that test to sit down and talk with a doctor about it. Depending on the doctor, some doctors are very anti-natural medicine. They'll look at it and they might just disregard it. But if you go to a naturopathic physician, we won't disregard something like that. We'll definitely look at it and look it over with you. And the way that the food allergy tests are done is you take blood samples yourself by finger stick. So they give you lancets and then you squeeze blood onto a card and you have to fill up little circles on cards and then you send it in. So you can just do it at home and take care of it yourself and send it in that way. There are other tests that are genomic tests where based on your genome, they'll tell you what foods are good for you and not. And so if you've done 23andMe or Ancestry DNA, you'll have a copy of your genome and you can, that there are companies that will, you give them a copy of that genome and then they'll make a report for you about what foods are good for you. You can also directly give them, you know, give them a sample. And those are very easy to do because they're cheek swabs. You know, doing a cheek swab is very simple. Usually you have to rinse out your mouth. They give you a cotton swab. You roll it in your mouth like 4 times or something. Or either do a rolling with cotton, or you have to do saliva. And they give you instructions for that. And somebody said to me, oh, I did the saliva test and I had to give a lot of saliva. It wasn't easy to do because you have to fill a little tube with saliva. So you're either going to give saliva, and saliva is obviously it's a little time intensive to do on the one hand, but on the other hand, it's easier to do than a finger stick. So, but the issue with that is when you do IgG food allergy testing, you're looking at real antibodies that are actually present in your blood. When you're doing a genetic test, you're assuming that your genetics are really what's going on in your body. And genetics are not necessarily destiny. Genetics indicate predispositions. They don't necessarily indicate what's actually going on in your body. When I do, I have a service that I use that gives me information about detoxification and methylation, and it gives me recommendations. And I will make recommendations to people if they have strong tendencies towards certain anomalies, detoxification and methylation. But I won't necessarily do all of them because it will depend on what's actually going on with the person. And, you know, when you do genetic testing, you really kind of have to correlate it with how the person is perfectly healthy and they have nothing wrong with them and they have a genetic predisposition to this or that. You may want to think again about giving them a particular supplement for that. If there's recommendations about, like general recommendations about how to eat, you might want to go in that direction. And the person could try it if it's harmless and see if they feel better. But that's the funny thing about doing genetic testing. It's not real time. It's your genetic code. And genes have to be flipped on. If the genes are not expressing, then you don't necessarily have to treat what's going on with them.
So fear of insurance industry finding out what your genetic background is aside, wouldn't this be like a really huge breakthrough in the medical industry to be able to look and see what someone's predisposed to?
Well, we think so.
Yeah, I understand. But the point is, the problem is, or as I see it being, you know, a minor conspiracy theorist, is that if the wrong people got a hold of that information, they could then increase or refuse your ability to get insurance.
Yeah, this is why we need huge insurance reform.
Yeah.
You should not be able to be refused. But there shouldn't be insurance. There should be health care.
What a tremendous breakthrough that would be, though.
Yes, it is a breakthrough. Well, and the thing is, too, genetics are used in regular medicine all the time. One of the things that we test for in the service I use is the MTHFR anomaly, and I used to be able to order that, and my patient's insurance would cover it. And then when we started ordering it a lot, the insurance company started to not want to pay for it. They don't really like to pay for genetic testing. There are certain genetic tests they will pay for, like they'll pay for the test for hereditary hemochromatosis. They feel like that predisposition is so serious that it's worth paying for. And you tend to only do that test when the person already comes back with an elevated ferritin. So, you know, I wouldn't, so I don't randomly test people for hereditary hemochromatosis. I do screen people for elevated ferritin. I test anybody who comes in, they're able to do it. I test their iron and ferritin to see if it's low, because having low iron is bad, because then you become anemic and you can't breathe and you don't have good oxygen exchange in your body. And if your ferritin is high, your iron storage protein is high, you're not going to, that's really bad for you. That causes oxidative damage in your body. It's very important to me to know what somebody's ferritin is. And if I see somebody's ferritin elevated, I will test them for hereditary hemochromatosis genetics. And because if they have the gene, they have to treat themselves differently than if they don't. And then they have to get the iron out of their bodies, and it's something they have. If they have the gene, then they have to monitor it for the rest of their lives, because having too much iron in your body causes oxidative damage. It's damaging to your liver. It's damaging to all of the organs in your body. All right. So insurance companies don't generally like to pay for genetic tests. We get them bounced, and recently we've started getting homocysteine bounced. I used to order homocysteine; it was no big deal. But insurance companies started deciding that it wasn't necessary to test homocysteine, that there are only very specific conditions that they will pay for a homocysteine test, and cardiovascular risk isn't one of them. Even though homocysteine is known to increase cardiovascular risk, they think the evidence is sketchy, so they won't pay for it. How cool is that?
Very cool.
Yeah. I've stopped. So what goes on now is there are certain tests I don't order because insurance companies started choking on it, because I don't want my patients to have to pay for something unnecessarily or pay for. So there are certain tests I've stopped ordering because I don't want to get it, because, you know, doing the process of appealing the test.
That is so sad.
And yeah, so there's certain tests I just don't do. I used to order very thorough thyroid testing where I do TSH, free and total T3, free and total T4. Insurance company came back to me and said, don't order both T3 total and T3 free. You can't do that. We're not going to pay for that.
You know, it's insane because they're making money off of this. And the thing is, there was, this is kind of fun, prior to 1973, there was not-for-profit health insurance. And then along came the first impeached president that actually quit, and his famous words were, "I am not a crook."
Right.
Yeah.
Nixon.
Richard Nixon.
Yes.
In 73, signed off on this Health Maintenance Organization Act of 1973, which medical insurance agencies, hospitals, clinics, and even doctors could begin functioning as a for-profit entity instead of the service organization they were intended to be.
Wow.
Boom.
That
there
was 1973.
Yeah, that's about the time I graduated from high school. So
but
I remember
HMOs, and we don't, mm-hmm. I guess there are still some HMOs around there. We just don't have them in Connecticut because we have insurance
right.
in Connecticut. But like out west, they have Kaiser Permanente.
Yes, which I've right. heard nothing but good about for the most part, but
you
I
have?
Don't know if that's true or not.
Oh, because when I was in naturopathic college, we heard issues.
Oh, okay.
Because they were very hard to work with because there was a lot of bureaucracy.
Well, that's. Yeah,
yeah.
Yeah.
So I don't know how they
probably
deal with
not,
it now.
They're probably not friendly with your branch of the healthcare.
They might not have been. And it's 20-odd years later, so things
sure.
may have changed. I have no idea because insurance coverage is a lot better in Oregon and Washington and stuff like that. So yes, so certain genetic tests insurance will tend to pay for. Certain genetic tests you wind up having to get pre-authorizations. And certain genetic tests they just won't pay for, and then certain tests they won't pay for. So, I've found that my test providing has been squelched somewhat by my fear that the insurance, because patients who have insurance that often they don't have a lot of money and they don't want to have to pay for extra tests, so if we. If we can get the information and help them without having all of that information, we do it. But sometimes there are tests that I really want to do. I had situations where I tested a person's MTHFR gene, the methyl tetrahydrofolate reductase gene. And if you have one of the anomalies, the C677T anomaly, you can get elevated homocysteine. Elevated homocysteine is an indicator of it's a cardiovascular risk. It causes increased clotting, causes your blood to be more coagulable. So I had done tests. I had a situation where I did the test. I did the MTHFR anomaly, which the patient had. The patient also had elevated homocysteine. So they had both the gene and the condition that the gene produces, and the insurance company wouldn't pay for it. Because they said it wasn't, I don't even know what their excuse was, but they wouldn't pay for it. The patient had the condition and they had the gene. That wasn't useful for, they think it's not useful for cardiovascular risk. They only pay for it in certain conditions. Like if the patient has homocystinuria, where they're releasing homocysteine in their urine, or if a patient is pregnant. That's it. So
what could it lead to financially?
What do you mean?
If you're not taking care of something like that.
Right. Well, I mean, if indeed homocysteine is an indicator of cardiovascular risk, and I don't know that the person has elevated homocysteine, then I might not, because what I do is I give them vitamins that will help to bring the homocysteine down, and they would not have that treatment. And so if their homocysteine is elevated enough, it could give them cardiovascular
risk.
So
they could be predisposed to heart.
To getting a blood clot.
Yeah.
Yeah. To
yeah.
getting a dangerous blood clot anywhere. Yep.
Why, I'm going to ask a silly question, and I know you're just going to roll your eyes when I say it, but why would an insurance company not pay for that to keep their client from eventually having a huge expense with them?
Does I know it seems like not seeing the forest for the trees because they're trying to because you know it's like Elizabeth Warren said, the insurance companies, they take the premiums, they try to collect as much money as they can and pay out as little as they can. That's their game, and they take the money, they take our money that we pay in premiums, and then they invest it. They make as much money as they can, and their game plan is to pay out as little as they can. So if they can figure out ways to not pay, they do. And so, you know, as in the doctor's office, you have a staff person. When you take insurance, that's why a lot of doctors go concierge and they go insurance free because it's so crazy making. So in a doctor's office, you have a staff person who their job is to fight with the insurance company. So you get a claim back and it's not covered. And so you have to appeal it.
I know you have one of those.
I do.
You do.
Yep. Mm. Yes, Ellen is a goddess. I worship.
she is. Shout out
I worship
to
the
Ellen.
Ground upon which she walks. Yes, she's a lovely, lovely person. And she fights for me and I adore her. So there. Anyway, and Ellen's a grandma, too. She spent time with her little grandbaby, and grandbaby's so cute.
Is that new?
So cute. Yes, recent.
Yes.
I believe it's Jen. Wait, I'm not sure if it's Jen or Lauren. Oh, my goodness. How embarrassing. I don't know if it's Jen or Lauren. But anyway, she's a proud grandma. So that's the thing. There's this Viome test. If you're interested in looking at it, you can check it out. Will it be helpful? I have an N of one. So one of my patients did have good results with it. Some of my patients do well with food intolerance testing, IgG food intolerance testing. So if you're interested in that, you can talk to a doctor about it. Unless your doctor's holistically oriented, they may not be interested in IgG food allergy testing, but a holistically oriented doctor definitely will be. I can't say for sure for everybody. I try to get people to work on the big bullies first before I do food allergy testing. And the big bullies, shout out to Jillian Tita, a naturopathic colleague who coined that phrase. The big bullies being stuff you eat all the time. Processed food, sugar, alcohol, caffeine, especially coffee, gluten, dairy, grains, and genetically modified organisms. So that's where I start with people. And yes, some people have problems with nuts and eggs and things like that, but people eat a lot of, you know, junk, just processed food that has chemicals and preservatives and stuff in it. People drink a lot of coffee, and coffee can upset your stomach. And people forget, and you know, I've said this before, but people treat coffee like it's a food. And I really think a lot of doctors may not be talking to their patients about how much coffee they're drinking. And people come in, so many people come in. I mean, what's the incidence of gastroesophageal reflux disorder? So what's the GERD incidence in the United States?
I don't know.
Yeah, so the incidence of GERD is a chronic and highly prevalent disorder. A recent systematic review, the prevalence of GERD is 18 to 28% in North America, 9 to 26% in Europe. Get this, 2.5 to 7.8% in East Asia. It's 8.7 to 33% in the Middle East. In Australia, it's like 23%. Isn't that? Or 23% in South America, it's 12% in Australia. But in the United States, is as high as 28% of people have reflux disorder. Middle East is very, there must be either there's a predisposition in the Middle East or there's something that they consume a lot of that gives them heartburn. 33%, it's like,
wow.
Or they're genetically predisposed to it or there's something that they eat a lot of that gives them heartburn. But in the United States, we're genetically diverse. And 28% of us have reflux, and reflux can be caused by, you know, being overweight, by eating food that we shouldn't be, you know, by eating there's all kinds of things that can predispose you to reflux disorder, but 28% of the population, that means there's something that the population in general is doing. And one of the things, I wonder about is coffee. People treat coffee like a food? And they forget that coffee is a drug. That
right.
Coffee has caffeine in it.
Yes, it does.
And coffee tends to be harder on people than tea, although tea can give you reflux too.
Yeah.
Because tea definitely, but caffeine itself can give you the reflux. And then I think there are oils in coffee that tend to be stimulating. And I know for me in my body that my stomach does worse with coffee than with the tea, and any kind of tea, whether it's black, green, or matcha, or anything like that. I'm much more likely to get a tummy ache. You know, two days in a row of coffee, I'm going to have some reflux symptoms. And you know that my favorite thing to do with coffee is to take this much.
Like I know. A quarter of a cup, by the way, if you're looking really closely at your radio right now, is about an inch of coffee in a standard cup.
Yes.
Just so you
That's
know.
That's right. Because I'm such a caffeine lightweight. A little goes a long way. I mean,
I'm more into feet than inches.
Right.
I like my coffee.
Well, I fixed my feet because, I put Neem on them and my feet are better now.
As a unit of measurement.
Yeah. So you like feet of coffee as opposed to inches. I got
you. Yes, absolutely.
Right. And it doesn't give you reflux. So you're fortunate.
I'm fortunate.
But you probably are a rapid metabolizer. Your CYP1A2 gene is probably, I can't remember if it's an AA or an ACE. Anyway, I'm probably the slow one, the really slow one, the CC.
I have been known to be a rapid metabolizer.
Of everything.
Pretty much everything. Yeah.
And you can drink a cup of coffee and go to bed.
I can.
Yeah, so you're a rapid metabolizer of caffeine. Right. I am not. I have to ration my, I like a little bit of caffeine. I like how it makes me feel, but I have to ration it. And I can't drink coffee every day. But people forget that coffee is a drug, and that if you're having digestive upset anywhere, it can give you loose stool, it can give you diarrhea, it can give you constipation, it can give you reflux. And it can also, of course, raise your blood pressure and give you heart palpitations and give you cardiac arrhythmias. So, you know, I wonder if doctors ask their patients how much, you know, they put people on high blood pressure meds. Are they asking them how much coffee they're drinking? They're putting their patients on reflux meds. Are they asking them how much coffee they're drinking? I don't know. But I just want to say this to you, that before you go taking a drug that's going to block your necessary stomach acid, which you need to absorb all kinds of vitamins and minerals and initiate your protein digestion and disinfect your food, before you go on a drug to go blocking that, maybe you want to think of, you know, cutting back on the coffee. And I know for me, if I have coffee a couple times a week, you know, 2 or 3 days a week, and I don't have too much, then I'm all right. But if I have it a fair bit every day, which happens sometimes, like when we go to Florida, I'll go get a cold brew every day, and I really shouldn't do that. And in fact, the last day we were there, I went and got a matcha tea, and that was I did a lot better with that. So anyway, so the big bullies being processed food, sugar, alcohol, caffeine, especially coffee, but other caffeine too, gluten, dairy, grains, and GMOs. And I'll tell people, I'll ask people, if people really want, if they walk in the first visit and they're like, please give me a food allergy test, I'll support them. I'm perfectly happy to do that. But if they haven't tried, you know, if I talk to them and I find out they're eating a lot of, you know, processed food, or they're having a lot of bread and they're having a lot of cheese, you know, they're going through to the drive-through and getting the big coffee with all the cream in it, I'll be like, you're having a few things all the time that could be aggravating. You want to try stopping those and see if you feel better. You know, because people want to find out that they have, this is my big joke, they're allergic to hazelnuts and kiwi fruit. And if I just avoid hazelnuts and kiwi fruit, I won't have any problems. No, it's not usually rare exotic things that you're allergic to. It's usually stuff you eat all the time. That's what it usually is. Yeah. So anyway, so those food allergy tests can be very interesting, and they've made them more economical and more accessible. So one of the things I am interested in, I have an Ancestry DNA kit that I've already paid for, and I just haven't sent it in. But I'm interested in doing it, because once you do that, there are other services that you can take your genome file and download it, and you get a discount because you already have the genome file, and they'll just you just give them your genome file, and then they'll do another report on it. And so I could then do that genetic food intolerance thing. And I'm also interested in doing, the finger stick thing. And so I'll probably do that before too long. I have a kit for that in my office. All right. So a couple more interesting things. We have just a few minutes left. I have a few more highlights. Nice highlights that I got from the New Hampshire conference, and we're still back with that. If I'm finding nice things I want to talk about in the moment, but then we have the we still have some backup information here that we want to share with you. Mm-hmm. So there was a study from Mexico about fluoride exposure, that if you have high fluoride exposure, so high fluoride exposure would mean that there's fluoride in the water, or maybe a child is taking fluoride tablets and maybe also getting fluoride in their toothpaste and eating it. One of the things about fluoride is you can't really, it's really hard to do fluoride with children if they, usually toothpaste for children is not fluoridated because children don't know enough not to swallow it.
Oh.
So you have to wait until a child understands that you spit toothpaste out. Because, a little kid, when you brush their teeth, they don't understand that. So you don't use fluoride with little kids.
Right. And the other thing is, if you're using something that's heavily fluoridated, you're not supposed to drink after, right?
Well, if you're, depending on what you're doing, if you're doing you have that that prescription paste that has the ridiculously high amount of fluoride, and then you have the other thing that I'm using, the casein paste, which I'm much more of a fan of because it has calcium phosphate in it.
Mm-hmm.
And that one has calcium phosphate and a little bit of fluoride. So I think that amount of fluoride is not a big deal. But when you're talking the other paste, is a little bit concerning. And because that paste you got, it had side effects with it, right?
Yeah, I guess, yeah.
And the paste that we used with the casein, the CPP, and with a little bit of fluoride, I don't have any problems with that. Have you?
No, not at all.
No, because the level of fluoride is a lot lower. But it's a lot lower because there's that calcium phosphate and that CPP, that casein protein, that helps to drive drive calcium into your teeth, which is really what your teeth need. So in this Mexican study, high fluoride exposure led to cognitive impairment and possibly ADHD.
Oh, lovely.
There was one study that kids were 4 years old, and the other study, the kids were ages 6 to 12. So you have to make sure your kids are not swallowing the toothpaste.
Mm-hmm.
But that's probably not how they're getting the fluoride. The high fluoride exposure would be if the water's fluoridated in your community. And if they're getting special fluoride treatments and maybe swallowing some of the fluoride or having highly fluoridated pastes. So that's something to look at. If you talk to a dentist, the best thing to do is to brush and floss. And if you eat sugar, not eating sugar is a really good idea specifically for your oral hygiene. But you know what a good remedy for eating sugar is to prevent tooth decay? It's going to shock you when you hear it. I having some water afterwards. Because sugar is water soluble. So if you have a sweet and then you drink water afterwards and make sure you swish it around in your mouth and you swallow the water and get the sugar out of your mouth, that's gonna help. when you're talking about preventing tooth decay, brushing and flossing regularly, because when you brush, you disrupt the plaque, and the plaque is biofilm. It's buildup of bacteria, particularly strep mutans, but other stuff, on your teeth, and the bacteria make a biofilm so it can hang around. And so when you brush, you disrupt the biofilm. You can also disrupt the biofilm with xylitol, which is why we have xylitol toothpastes and xylitol candies,
mm-hmm.
And mouth rinse with xylitol in it. But simple brushing and flossing can go a huge way to help you. And then when you have dental floss, you get in there in between your teeth and you stimulate the gums, and you get the floss out from underneath the surface. And you can floss with dental floss. You can also use a rubber tip, and that gives you good stimulation of your gums. And you can use a water flosser. And there are different brands of water flossers that you can get a little handheld unit that squirts water. It's very easy. That's a really nice thing if you have appliances in your mouth. If you have bridges or you have things that are hard to get around, or if you're using dentures or that kind of thing. Those can be, that's a really nice option, especially if you have braces. If you have braces, the water flosser is a great idea.
That would be an essential. Yeah.
Because I remember when I had braces.
You can't take them out.
No. When I had the braces 8 million years ago, my dentist gave me basically a needle, not really a needle, but a plastic loop. It was a big loop that you attached floss to so you could thread it through your teeth. Oh, my compliance was just so great for that.
Oh.
Right. Right. So a water flosser makes a lot more sense because water flosser is just very easy to do. Water flossing is messy, though. I didn't realize that.
I was going to say, you might want to do it in the shower.
You can do it in the shower, and or you just lean.
If it's battery operated,
you lean over the sink because it's messy. The water. You have to lean over the sink because you'll get yourself
it's
wet.
It's gonna make a huge mess.
Right.
So I do it in the shower.
So I don't. I haven't. I have a water flosser. I haven't tried it yet. Silly me.
No.
Yeah, I bought
didn't know
one.
You had
and
one
I,
of those.
I do. It's a hand right because I haven't cracked it. But I do. I am
Let's
very diligent with my. With the dental floss.
Yeah.
I have dental floss that's infused with cardamom.
Okay.
And cardamom is really, as you know, it's really good for your
really
gum
good.
Health.
Yeah.
And then I have a rubber tip. And then I have a herbal mouth rinse. I talked to a dentist, not my dentist, but another dentist. I had a conversation with her. She said, "You're doing too much."
Like, "You're doing too much?"
She said I was doing too much. It's all right. I have a very, intense hygienist.
If you go to the American Dental Association, they tell you that it's all about the fluoride. They're really
into the fluoride.
Yeah,
I
five
know.
Reasons why fluoride in water is good for communities, and it's like, ugh.
But then you're drinking the fluoride. The whole
exactly.
point of the
you're
fluoride.
You end up drinking it. It seems crazy.
The thing is, the fluoride, the point of the fluoride is that it should be applied topically.
Right.
To stop up the lacunae, the little lakes in your teeth, so that the plaque can't get in.
I know.
And so applying a paste with a small amount of fluoride seems to make more sense than drinking it. I don't know that getting fluoride into your body is going to, because aren't you, once your teeth are your teeth, do they heal? I think they heal externally.
Yeah.
And so if you apply a paste to them that has calcium and fluoride in it, that makes more sense to me. Calcium phosphate has definitely been shown to remineralize teeth, and that's really the way to go. And that's in both our mouth rinse and in our in that paste that we use.
So. Mm-hmm.
All right, I'm going to go.
You're there.
Because it's your turn. So you have been listening.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you've been listening to Radio Naturopath, the call-in talk show about health and natural medicine. I am Fran Storch, ND, naturopathic physician, with my co-host, Ron Meniza. You can also email me with questions and comments at radionaturopath@gmail.com. If you'd like to listen to this show at another time, you can check out our podcast at whus.org. You can also leave questions or comments at my Facebook page, Twitter, and Instagram, @FranStorchND. The views expressed on this program do not reflect the views of the staff, management, or licensee of this station. Thank you for listening to Radio Naturopath, your show where you can learn about the best of science and nature. We'll be back with more Radio Naturopath next week at 91.7 FM, WHUS Storrs.